How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
So welcome to Chatter. Thank you for joining us. And I did, as we were saying earlier, I just ordered Half American, Matt Delmont, which was your take on Blacks in World War II, and you now own that turf. And then you turn to this, to Vietnam. So here's what David Meredith had to say about your book, Matt Delmont. He said, brilliant and timely, a captivating book by a gifted storyteller. In the book is Until the Last Gun is Silent, a story of patriotism, the Vietnam War, and the fight to save America's soul. But can you share with us the story about how you decided to use, I use that word carefully, Coretta Scott King and the Medal of Honor winner to tell this story?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. So Half American was my last book. It's about Black Americans in World War II. And almost every time I gave a presentation on that book, someone would ask about the Vietnam era. You know, what changed between World War II and Vietnam? And so I started reading everything I could on the time period, knew I wanted to work on the Vietnam War. And as I read more, I kept coming across Coretta Scott King and her role in the anti-war movement. And so I knew I wanted to focus on her as sort of the anti-war voice in the story. But then credit goes to my dad, my late father, for pointing me in the direction of Dwight Skip Johnson, who is a Medal of Honor winner. I was talking to my dad shortly before he passed, talking about the Vietnam era, because he knew I was working on a book on the topic. And he could sort of remember the story about a guy who was about his same age from Detroit who won the Medal of Honor. Couldn't remember the name, but he gave me enough clues that when I got home, I started looking it up and was able to find out he was talking about this guy named Dwight Skip Johnson. So that kind of average working class Black guy from Detroit. And so I use him to talk about the larger military history of Vietnam, because he was really illustrative of the working class experience of that whole generation that got drafted to fight in the war.
Yeah. I'm constantly surprised by things. And I knew I thought I knew a fair amount about Coretta Scott King's role. And, you know, we've talked about a lot in different versions on this show, but often the women haven't been written about. You didn't really appreciate their role. I had no idea about so many things about Coretta Scott King. And this sounds superficial, but it's not. I had no idea she was a performer. She was a singer. That was a big part of it. And I had no idea about the sheer volume of work she did and speeches she would do and rallies she would lead and marches she would march in. Independent and separate of Martin Luther King. Did that surprise you as you were researching this? It's phenomenally researched, by the way.
Oh, I appreciate it. It absolutely did surprise me. You know, my favorite part about being a historian and working on a book like this is that you learn so much in the course of doing the research. And so I knew there was something there with Coretta Scott King, but once I actually got into the materials, I listened to interviews that she did, I read hundreds of newspaper articles, just got a tremendous sense of how important she was as a leader in her own right. I think a lot of people just think of her as the wife and widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which she always said she was proud to be that, but that she understood she was so much more. And he actually gave her credit for influencing his position on the war. He said, she educated me. If I can offer one anecdote, I think one of the things that was important for me in trying to tell her story was just figuring out where to look for her in the historical materials. When you look at these historical newspaper databases, if you search for Coretta Scott King, you get about 300 results. If you search for Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr., you get three times that many. That's the convention of the era. That's how she was referred to. Or talking about newspapers, if you looked at the women's sections, that's where a lot of the coverage of Coretta Scott King would be. And the interviews were fascinating because they would ask her, you know, what'd you make your kids for breakfast? What's it like having Martin travel all the time? And then the next paragraph would be, and we know you just spoke to 20,000 people at a rally at Madison Square Garden. Right? And so that's what it looked like to be a woman activist and a woman leader in that era.
And she just kept doing it. Something you just said made me think about this again. I feel like I know a certain amount about the Vietnam War and the protests and everything else. The sheer scale of both the number of people who were sent to fight in these wars, 300,000 plus Black Americans, the number of people who would show up at these protests. You know, if 500 people show up at the Northwest Gate of the White House in Washington, we're like, woo, you know, major protest, and it's leading the news. But she, again, I'm going back to Coretta Scott King. She would be ahead of a rally or a protest or a march with 20,000, 30,000 people. The scale of the opposition was surprising to me.
The scale and how it increased over the course of the war.
Yeah.
So I just mentioned there's this important rally at Madison Square Garden in 1965. That was really important because that was one of the first times mainstream civil rights activists got up and spoke out against the war. This was before most politicians, before most Americans were willing to speak out against the war as it was starting to ramp up. She kept speaking out and led major marches in 66, 67. And then after Martin Luther King was assassinated, she leads protests in Central Park of 80,000 people. Right, she's there dressed in all black.
When's the last time there's been a protest of 80,000 people in Central Park?
Yeah, and
the
moratorium marches in Washington, D.C. in the fall of 1969, right? Tens of thousands of people. In the case of the second one, hundreds of thousands of people were there.
Half a million.
And the next day in the paper, she's the one whose picture is there, right? She's leading candlelight marches. She's the one speaking. And so I think when we think about the era, part of my goal in writing the book was to put her back front and center as one of the leading voices of the anti-war movement in that time period.
Yeah. And one of the leading influences on him, on Martin Luther King. I don't want to take
Absolutely.
Away from her, but he seemed really, Martin Luther King seemed very challenged by or really struggling with, okay, is it unpatriotic to be against the war? And does it take away from the war on poverty, which he really, really cared about? And she was the one that was really pushing him, right?
That's right. He really felt like he was boxed in, right? Because he understood that to get the key civil rights legislation they needed, he needed to win and maintain the support of President Johnson. And he understood that anything he did that was counter to President Johnson's foreign policy was going to be dangerous. And that's how it played out. In 1965, King did start to speak out, kind of dipped his toes in the water of speaking out against the war. Senator Dodd from Connecticut came out in all the major newspapers and condemned him for it. He said, what business do you have speaking out against the war? You're a civil rights leader. You don't know anything about foreign policy. And so Credo was really influential in convincing and really cajoling Martin to speak out against the war. When he won the Nobel Prize in 64, she saw that as a turning point because she understood, you know, this is a challenge to both of us, not just to be civil rights leaders, but to think about the global scale of human rights. And so if you can kind of picture their relationship, they were equals as activists, they were equals as leaders. And she, over the dinner table, she was constantly encouraging him, nudging him, pushing him to speak out, which he finally did, of course, in 1967 with the Riverside speech.
Did your impressions, your perception, your opinions of him change as you were working on this?
I think going back to the era and just remembering what gender dynamics looked like in that time period, some of the her recollections of the March on Washington, how disappointed the women and the wives who were leaders themselves were to not be able to march alongside it in the main march, not be able to speak at the March on Washington. And there's a scene she describes of being in a limousine after the march as Martin's about to go to a meeting with President Kennedy in the White House. And she's hoping that she'll be able to go in as well, since this is her one chance to maybe meet a president. They get to the gates of the White House and he says, you're not invited. You can't come in. And so Martin goes in, Coretta stays in the limo, goes back to the hotel. You know, she was pissed about that. Right? She understood
just
that. She.
I read that out loud to my husband a couple of times. Like, can you believe this? Can you believe this?
And so I think that part's frustrating. But I think to Martin's credit, when he's interviewed in 1965 by a television reporter, the reporter says, you know, I've seen your wife out there giving these speeches. You must have really influenced her, huh? And Martin, to his credit, says, no, she educated me. Right? I would love to be able to satisfy my ego and say I led her on this, but she didn't. So
he did step up. Okay, tell us about Skip Johnson, who, as I think you said early on, had been kind of captured. Most of the writing about him is he had this incredible situation that got him the Medal of Honor and then had this terrible end. But tell us about Skip.
Yeah, if you were to Google Skip Johnson, you'd come across two things. One, that he earned the Medal of Honor for fighting his way out of an ambush, and then later he died in a tragic incident in Detroit. So I knew that going in, but I knew I also wanted to be able to tell a broader story. And so Skip Johnson's story, he's a young black man who grows up in the Jeffries Projects in Detroit, working class guy. Graduates from high school in 1966. And like so many men, he's drafted the summer after he graduates from high school. Goes to training at Fort Knox in Kentucky and gets assigned to a tank unit. He's in the 69th Armor Regiment. He goes to Vietnam in January of 1967. He's there almost a year. And just about 2 weeks before he's about to come home, his unit is caught in an ambush. And he performed heroically. He fought his way out of it. He helped to save the lives of many men in his unit. And then he's immediately sent back home. And for those first 6 months, he doesn't hear anything from the Army. He's just trying to get back to life in Detroit, falls in love with a woman named Katrina, who I had a chance to interview.
Best.
Yeah, Katrina's awesome. They get married. And then kind of out of nowhere, he gets a call that he's received the Medal of Honor. And then 2 weeks later, he's supposed to go to the White House. So the first time he ever goes to Washington, D.C. is to go to the White House and receive the Medal of Honor from President Johnson. It's a really big deal in late 1968 because there's a lot invested in this black man receiving the Medal of Honor, right? This is a year and a half after the Detroit riots. It's after King's assassination, after all the tumult of 68. A lot of people are looking to his story as sort of an example of unity or hope in the United States. And so he's celebrated by the governor of Michigan, by the mayor of Detroit, by business leaders at Ford and elsewhere.
And they really trotted him out. I started, as I was reading it, hi, David Marinus. You were probably digging out ice and snow, weren't you?
It was a little worse than that, but I'm fine now.
Okay. Well, you know Matt Dillon, so say hi. Okay.
Matt, wait. Great. We actually have never met, but we've certainly connected.
Yeah. Good to see you, David.
Yes. So, Matt, he was being trotted out. I mean, that's a horrible expression, but he was really being trotted out by everybody, right?
Yeah, he was being trotted out by everyone. The way his widow, Katrina, described it as a horse and pony show, right?
Yeah.
Or dog and pony show. They wanted to see the medal rather than the man. And like so many veterans from that war, he came home and he was struggling with the trauma that he experienced, right?
Yeah.
He had health issues, he had mental issues, and he recognized it himself. He ends up checking himself into an army hospital. The story I try to tell about Skip is that one of the reasons his story is important is that he was one of the first people diagnosed with what they call at the time post-Vietnam syndrome.
Yeah.
They later called it PTSD. And so the psychiatrists, Robert J. Lifton and others who start to do the important work to get that diagnosis recognized in the medical community, they're pointing to Skip's story. They're going to all these medical conferences and saying, look, at the experience of this Medal of Honor winner who served the country so bravely, but then really struggled when he came home.
Yeah. I kept focusing on the speed. One day he's in high school. The next thing he's at Fort Knox. The next thing he's, in Vietnam. And then they send them home and there's no transition. There's no, okay, let's help you, reacclimate, et cetera. The speed was insane. Hey, David Marinus, I know we don't have you for long, probably, because you've got other engagements this evening. But I was talking earlier about your blurb on the back. And you said about Matt's book, Brilliant and Timely, a Captivating Book by a Gifted Storyteller. I think you're one of the best storytellers out there. And even if you hadn't blurbed the book, I was going through this until the last gun is silent. I need to say that multiple times. It's wonderful stories. It's, in many ways, tragic stuff, but it's wonderful stories. But what was your attraction to the book?
Well, the attraction was that it's something that hasn't been written before. First of all, aside from, Bloods and a few books about black soldiers in Vietnam and what they endured, there hadn't been a book that really dealt with the totality of it through these two characters. And I love the way he brought them together. And that requires more than just good reporting and good writing. It requires good thinking. And that's really what I loved about the book, the way he sort of created, no one else could write this book. It's one of those books where you just have to create this world and base it on real hard reporting and good writing. And so I just love the whole concept of it and the way he pulled it off.
Absolutely great stories. David Aldridge, I can see you've got something on your mind.
I do. it was a great book. And Matthew, I wanted to kind of couch this in coming from the world of sports where I come from. The whole notion of protest toward the Vietnam War, against the Vietnam War, almost always centers on Ali. Always, always. It's always Ali standing in Houston, not taking the step. I ain't got no quarrel than Viet Cong, the whole thing. And it rightly so, because it was a seismic thing for an athlete to do. But in talking about Skip Johnson, I'm so glad that you were able to kind of show that it was ordinary African-American people, and almost all men, that had to bear the brunt of the second half of the Vietnam War after Johnson started this program where he just put 100, because he had to find somebody to fight. And he found, 100,000 people, most of whom were African-American, to just be cannon fodder, basically, so that he can keep his war going. And I just wonder, do you think the opposition that African American soldiers had Did it crystallize quicker than other groups did? Because there was a lot of opposition. It was all races, all obviously, as you so show with Mrs. King and lots of other women, Bella Abzug, and a lot of women were anti-war way before the men were. But do you think it crystallized for African-American soldiers quicker than it did for white soldiers who also were in the same place getting shot up in a war that didn't make any sense?
It's a great question.
Yeah, I love the question. And I think it did. And I, one of the reasons it did was the knowledge of what military service meant to different communities. I think that's one thing that comes through really clear is that for the generation that got drafted into Vietnam or even volunteered for Vietnam, they had dads, uncles, grandfathers who had served, right? And there was this always this hope in the Black community that by demonstrating patriotism, by demonstrating military service, that it was going to lead for increased equality, increased civil rights on the other end. I
Wasn't
think
it, I'm sorry, wasn't it called double patriotism? Wasn't that an expression?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah. So it was double victory was the key
double
phrase
victory,
from the World War II, right? And yeah. The idea there was victory over fascism abroad, winning the military war, and then victory over racism at home, right? I think by the time you get to Vietnam, there's a sense that those promises start to ring hollow. Even though there's a lot of pride in the fact that the military is finally integrated, that there are more opportunities for African Americans in the military, there's a sense, particularly given the contours of that war, that you know this isn't the battle that we're meant to fight. And then once you get prominent people like Muhammad Ali, like Coretta Scott King, eventually like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking out against the war, that does start to crystallize Black military opposition to the war fighting earlier and at a greater volume than you see from a lot of other troops.
You know,
great.
David, when you said that you think that Ali was the sort of the figure, I disagreed slightly. I think it was Martin Luther King. Who was much more the intellectual Black spokesman against the war.
Well, I just
and what
mean
he
in
said.
Terms of sports people. Did.
Yeah, okay, in terms of sports,
about.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Got That's it. Where usually.
But what I think that what Matt does so valuably is show that it was Coretta that pushed all of this. You know, and,
huge.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And it's such a cliche. But when you see some guy who's, I can say this because I'm the girl in the room, like there's always, almost always, a partner, and it's usually a woman, back there going, okay, you need to do this, you need to do that. But I went at Matt, after I read the book, I went looking for other stuff on Coretta Scott King, and I just haven't seen this written. And again, the things of which we were not aware, what her career was like, her dedication to those children, how she kept, you know, being a mom on top of everything else was just nuts. And then I really, not that I thought one way or the other, but he really did. Martin Luther King really did step up when asked and say, no, she educated me. That was phenomenal. And I don't know that most people know that. We all have these images in our mind. There's a classic photograph of her, a black and white photograph of her at his funeral. And that's kind of the image people have of the adoring spouse, you know, the tragedy. Wow. I mean, she was just a force in and of herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that she was a singer, right? And so one of the things that I think is so powerful is her role model is Paul Robeson, right? The powerful actor, activist, and singer. When she saw him perform and how he would sing and then weave in political commentary, she modeled her own freedom concerts after that, right? And so she was monitored by the FBI just in the same way that Dr. King and other civil rights activists were, and she knew that. So she, I think her willingness to step up. And the way I try to frame it in the book is she made it possible for people to be brave together, right? If people knew that she was leading a march, that they would feel comfortable being out there in the streets with her. And that was powerful to be able to motivate that many average Americans across all these different demographics to protest against the war.
Yeah. Did you ever look, somewhere I bet you could find recordings of her singing.
Yes, there are a handful.
Wow.
And one of the key sources for the book, which I have to credit my friend, the historian Jean Theo Harris, for pointing me in this direction, at the University of Florida, there are about 20 hours of archived oral history interviews that she did, where she describes all aspects of her life, which is a really valuable source for this. But there were parts there where she would stop, where she would pause talking and start to sing periods. And just to be able to hear both her spoken voice, but also her singing voice is just amazing.
So great. Okay, let's get you out with this before. Okay, again, David Aldrich, in honor of you, we're not going to do 60 seconds more. It's too serious. We just can't. It's too serious a topic. It's how we get our Patreon, Matt, but we're not going to do it to you. But again, your research is phenomenal. And I went back and looked at Half American, your book about World War II, and I go, okay, I need that book. And I started reading. Your research is phenomenal. You have opinions about things. How did the work on this book, if it did, change your opinion, your perspective, what you thought you knew about this chapter of history?
I think it solidified for me the idea that patriotism and dissent are intertwined. I think at the end of this book, I knew that going in that I wanted to sort of think about those concepts. But as I finished it and as I think about the book in the context of the world we live in right now, it's that patriotism and dissent are intertwined. I think we're at a weird moment politically where it seems like those are polar concepts where you can only be patriotic or only be dissenting. But the reality for most Americans, and certainly for most Black Americans, is that patriotism has always been interwoven with a willingness and a necessity to critique the parts of the country that are not living up to its ideals. And I
and
think
this,
these stories
this
really
is
amplify that.
What I'm about to say, and David or Claude will save me, this is not as stupid as it sounds. It's going to sound really stupid. But there are a couple of U.S. athletes competing in the Olympics right now who have talked about the challenges and their mixed feelings about representing the United States of America in the Olympics. It's nowhere near as serious as what, you know, what you covered, but it is similar. And I think that's one of the, it's one of the many things, not just the Olympics, that makes your book so current and so relevant. It's fabulous. Okay, David Aldrich, David Marinus, anything before we let him go?
Well,
well, go ahead, David. You go.
I was just saying, Tori, it's not just athletes. I mean, it's that message of patriotism and dissent is right at the heart of what's going on in America right today.
Absolutely. And I love, Matt, that you had Goodell in there, Senator Goodell in there.
It's sort of,
isn't that amazing?
Yeah, his dad was awesome.
Yeah, no.
Awesome.
You just go, what happened?
Stop. He's the youngest of five boys, Roger Goodell is. I'm the youngest of five girls. We're like close personal. Stop. Okay, this would be the last question if we had done, Matt Delmont, if we had done 60 seconds more. What's next?
You know, for the first time in 20 years, I actually don't know. I've gone from one book to another for the last 20 years, and I don't know what exactly is next. I remain really interested in military history, and so I might work in something in that space. But I hopefully in 6 months' time, I'll have an idea, and I'll then a few more years from now, you'll see another book out.
Excellent. We would love to have you back. Okay, everybody. David Marinus, I can't even remember who first pitched me on this book, but I loved it. And so I was all over it. And then I saw your blurb and I said, okay, we have to do it. So thank you, David Marinus. Thank you very much. Everybody, okay, quick housekeeping. The pitch is underway. We've got some really good nominations coming in. A quick reminder that the pitch is about independent bookstores fueling this competition. They are nominating authors from around the country. It's going great. Check us out on chatteronbooks.com. And we are going to have in a couple of weeks, okay, this is like from the sublime to the ridiculous, but in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Rebecca Lehman on, and she has this great book called The Beheading Game. Now, anybody who listens to the show knows I'm all about the Tudors and Anne Boleyn and everybody else, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. And you think to yourself, who could write anything about Anne Boleyn you care about? So this woman, Rebecca Lehman, who's really interesting, has done a reimagining of that. And it's if you're inside Anne Boleyn's head. That's all I can tell you. But it's going to be great. But in the meantime, everybody, go out and buy Until the Last Gun is Silent. It is fabulous. It's by Matthew F. Delmont. It's really a wonderful read. And thanks, everybody. Thanks, David Marinus.
Sorry, I was late.
That's all right. We'll have you back. Bye. Bye, David. Bye, Claude. Love you guys.